Can we move through the operation plan, bring this to item nine, CEO report. Trey.
Well, I'm assuming you all read it. Does anybody have any questions?
Good job, Trey.
Yeah, what was in it?
Yeah, I read it, but it was in it.
I gave my typical legislative update on moving parts at the federal and state level.
Do we have anything back that we need to be working on DC with of immediate concern? I know you've been working on some different things off and on, but is there anything moving?
There's a couple of energy bills that are currently in flux. There's a purple law being reviewed currently under FERC, which is a big deal. There's a few things.
So the purple law, I know that came up with the city of Ketchikan and Cape Fox at one time, and they're trusting it.
And SEPA,
and it was in regards to a small utility being able to sell, but then it was a renewable placement renewable. So are they looking at lowering levels or doing something in regards to?
There's some various thresholds within the current purple law that they're looking at. I've read through them, and I think they're mostly favorable, but okay. They're starting to get some pushback, so I'm going to see, just kind of monitoring and to see where it goes from here. So I finally had a person to be heard. we're monitoring that, but right now we're not actively chasing any particular legislation in D.C.
Okay.
But some of those things are timing-wise. You know, sometimes they get into these breaks, and, you know, this impeachment thing and everything is kind of taking the air out of the room, and things have slowed to a crawl even more than they were. So, of course, at the state level, I've talked about SB 123, and we'll be monitoring that. And we still have some work to do there. I've reached out to Senator Coghill's office and also working with our lobbyist in Juneau, and probably end up flying up there in the next week or so to address some issues.
Okay.
And meet with them. We'll see if we can fit that in between before the holidays. They formed a committee, but the committee hasn't met yet, so still working. I did a fairly long write-up on the roadless rule in here, just because I know it was an important issue to the member utilities, and at our previous meeting, I highlighted that, you know, if you were ever going to weigh in on the rule, now would be a good time. And I'm sure, as all you know, that, you know, SEPA's opposed the roadless rule from the beginning, I think, for the most part. And regardless of what the Forest Service likes to say about how they've approved every project that they've ever done or anybody's ever applied for, those are conditional improvements. First of all, most of them aren't even utility projects to begin with. And more importantly, they just, as you know, when we tried to do the KPI, they forced us into doing shovel trails. When there's an existing road there, why can't you put a little spur down to get to where you got to put your pole in? No, you got to do a shovel trail. So it's those little things that they kind of push you in. They say, well, that'll never get approved, so you got to go this way.
What's a shovel trail?
It's essentially just a temporary primitive trail to get down there. And then also mats and things of that nature, as opposed to roads that you would eventually use for long-term maintenance. And there just seems to be a complete disregard for cost. If there's any way that you could put a line in with a helicopter as opposed to putting a road, they're going to force you to try to do it with a helicopter. Doesn't matter if it's the same cost or 100 times the cost. That's just been my experience. So I still firmly believe that there's enough protections that were pre-existing before. I always speak specifically about utilities, transmission, communications, those type of things that are specific to our industry. Trying to leverage that, because their real core issue might be logging or something like that. I don't want to get into that fray. But specifically for our industry, if you poll utilities around the state, you'd be hard-pressed to find one that doesn't support getting rid of the roadless rule. I think those things were attempted to be addressed in the forest plan, and I'm an advocate for trying to solve issues at the lowest level possible, at the local level, where stakeholders live and actually know what the issues are and find practical solutions, rather than a bureaucrat in D.C. making the call that's never been here. So anyway, I've helped a couple of other organizations and been asked to participate and give them feedback on their comments during the comment period. The comment period ends on the 17th. I do appreciate the member utilities taking up the issue and at least having the conversation with their constituents and raising awareness on it. People are entitled to vote how they want to on that, but for our industry, it definitely adds cost to the ratepayers at the end of the day. And anything that adds cost to the ratepayers at the end of the day, it's my duty to try to advocate for fixing those problems. So, anyway, I won't linger on that any longer unless anybody has some questions. But and then
I'd like to thank you for your work on that. I know that that committee put a lot of work into it, and there's a lot of different stakeholders to get to a decision. So,
thank you. Appreciate that. SEPA office, I had talked briefly on that earlier, and essentially that's moving along. I'm going to slow play it a little bit. We're not in a big hurry. We've got some time. We don't have a lot of money to spend on it right now anyway, so we'll take our time and see if we can get a good project to bring forward to the board with some reasonable numbers to give you a sense where that falls out at, and get your feedback, and we'll work it from there. And as always in my report, I try to include comments on best practices and process improvements. This is something that we work on every day. We're always trying to do things better, more efficiently, more cost effectively, and not only for the near term, but for the long term too. And sometimes people lose sight of that. It's easy to do, to deal with the daily issues that involve your attention and try to take that away, but you also have to look at the long term. And I think when you guys have seen it for as long as you've been involved with the organization, that majority of our R&R projects are clearly geared toward taking care of obsolescence issues, making it so we can maintain our equipment in a reliable fashion and with the highest availability. We also focus on a lot of safety, and what comes with that is best practices. Those things evolve over time. It's easy to become stagnant, and we've always done it this way, but that's not to say that there's not better ways to do that. That's one of the values of getting our folks out, myself included, to work with other managers in the industry, and it helps us on this best practices front. People have identified weak links out there. They've had lost time accidents, or they've lost equipment, had major failures. Those are the types of things we like. I like to learn from other people's mistakes. It's a lot cheaper. So we'll continue to do that. And of course, as you'll see too here, we've been trying to bolster some of our standard operating procedures, not only in the plants, but at some of our facilities, airports, and docks. Things you thought may have, why would you need an SOP for that? Well, when you start digging into it, there's some things that you should be doing and trying to standardize how people deal with that particular area. So, and we'll keep doing that and try to make the best we can. Good news also is, we're fully staffed, and we've got a real solid team right now, and things are performing well. I'm happy with it. And I hope you are too. So, that's all I got, sir.
Thank you. Any questions? in regards to the CEO report. Thank you, Trey. Brings us on down to item 10, staff reports, operating manager report. Clay.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've covered some of these issues to some degree previously in the year, so I'm just going to kind of highlight, and then if you've got additional questions, you can hit me up here. I think most of you are pretty familiar with the Tai Access Road project. The picture, figure one up there, kind of highlights the issue as well as anything will. That little thin strip of water just off the point, that's the access channel that we have to try and send a barge up at least twice a year. And anyway, it's access out there has been an issue even since the 70s when Sykes Logging was out there. That's why Sykes Logging put the airstrip that we now use in place out there. But as far as getting heavy goods and emergency access, that little thin strip of water is our access point, and that's not even the bad spot. So anyway, the spot that we that came about as the as our IM review of it is that location just off the aircraft's wing there is the preferred location. And anyway, so the next step to this will be to complete the preliminary study of looking at what it's going to actually take to get the road to that location. And we had funds budgeted for that earlier this season, but it was a six-month budget, kind of a short window to get in there and get the work done. And unfortunately, the bids that came back were in excess of what we had budgeted for that. So we'll look at circling around and getting that done this next season. And once we get those numbers in place for what it looks like it's really going to cost to get that job done, then we'll be looking for some direction from the board as to whether or not we want to proceed with that. Move on to the fire control panel at Tai. Most everybody's pretty familiar with that. The panel that's in place out there, no longer supported by the factory. We've got a retrofit that will fit in the box, and we just need to make up the connections, and it will be operational. But we are also adding an additional zone that will protect our diesel generator down in the basement. An update for this, was expected to be finished at the end of the calendar year this year. It's pending, the plans are pending approval from the state fire marshal, and as with everything else at the state level these days, kind of on a slow roll right there. So anyway, they had thought that we would have those plans back and approved by now, and that they would be moving up to get this project done. They still haven't got the plans back from the fire marshal yet. So anyway, not going to happen before the end of the year, but it's anticipated that as soon as they get those back from the marshal, fire marshal, that they can go ahead and get started. The replacement panel is already on site, just some workers and additional conduit and approval to get started with the plan. That is all we're working on right now. Moving on to the Swan Tai Guidable project. This is a project specific to the intertie, and this was just a, I don't know, for lack of a better word, maybe a design flaw that was discovered after the fact. And just the way that those guy wires ride in the thimble, as you can see, they're right into the edge of the shackle there. And review came to the decision that that would eventually start to bite into the preform, into the eye there, and would eventually fail. And so the repair for that is a guy thimble that actually goes inside the eye of the cable, and then an additional guy thimble insert that makes that a whole lot more robust application. So anyway, we've got 3 years of work under our belt doing these, and it looks like we've got three more years before it's done. So that's where that's at. Next one is a heat pump for the Wrangell warehouse. Heat pumps are one of those things that just sort of sell themselves these days. And so, given that most of our heat in the office area and all inside the warehouse is all resistance-based electric heat, we all know that heat pumps are a much more efficient way of accomplishing the same thing. And kind of part of a broader energy efficiency demand side management program that we've been kind of implicating in there. We've already replaced the overhead lights with LED. and now we're replacing our resistance-based heater with a heat pump. We've got a ceiling fan in the place, so we're just trying to squeeze every bit of value out of every kilowatt of power that goes into that place. So anyway, that is expected to be completed by the end of the calendar year.
So what do you figure your cost is on this heat pump?
Oh, installed, we're looking at $7,300 installed.
And why, did you pick out that particular model? It seems like...
Locally supported.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Local contractor, locally supported. If they have an issue, you call them up and they come fix it.
Okay.
So, the brushing program made some pretty good progress this season. And one of those elements of that progress was, if you look at the very end of that aircraft, you see a little tiny... something hanging right off the nose right there, and that happens to be a GoPro camera, and we were able to go out and actually fly and document the entire length of the right-of-way this season. And based on that, we've been developing the spreadsheets for every foot of the right-of-way, and now we're able to go back and review all of that footage and plug that information into our Excel spreadsheets, documenting just exactly where the heck different sections of the line are now. And at the close of the regular brushing season, we took our brushing foreman and we chained him to a desk and we had him plug in all that information in, and we're almost completely done with that now. So anyway, it's not only does that, will that GoPro footage be very handy in going back and referencing different sections of the line as far as the brushing conditions go, but from a maintenance standpoint as well. If we have any question what a different section of the line looks like, is that a tangent structure, how many guy wires, where's the helipad, you pull it up on your computer and you fly there and you pause it and you sit there and look at it and you know just exactly what the heck you got. So anyway, felt like we've made some really good progress on in that front this year. Moving on to the helipads at Cleveland Peninsula, I noted a typo here in one of the last sentences of the first paragraph, and where it refers to 43 pads in service and 20 have failed. That's actually 10 that have completely failed. So not near as bad as the narrative.
And Clay, the timing of the replacement, we pushed that out 1 year.
Okay, right. Okay. So anyway, these are the Cleveland Peninsula pads, and this is a portion of this is shared with the STI as well, and it's some of the most hostile terrain imaginable up that way. It gets an incredible amount of snow, really gets beat up on, and some of these spots are pretty darn hard to access without these helipads. And so I understand that we pushed this back, but to get in and actually hike into some of these locations would be pretty doggone difficult. Not that it couldn't be done, but anyway, if we had to get in there and make some sort of repair, these pads really help expedite the access and the safety of that access. So I'm hoping after we've had a chance to regroup that we can get back on it as soon as we can. So let's move on to the wood pole testing. Had a good season with this thing. Got to go put a little bugger out in the field. Electric Power Constructors, they put a field of two out on Mitkoff Island, and we did a 10% sample of all the wood poles on Mitkoff. They had about 211 poles over there, and we did 22 of them. And the results came back pretty good. Everything's, as a 10% samples go, there wasn't anything that raised a bunch of eyebrows thinking, oh my gosh, we better make plans to get in there and change these out. So,
and 10% is good enough for you to extrapolate
it's,
that?
It's a good baseline. It's a good baseline. We'll follow up with more. But now what you're seeing right there in the picture is an example of one that's potentially failed. You see that little gap right there? So this is one of Petersburg's poles. I'd have to look and see which one it is. But anyway, this was one of the ones, I believe, just outside the powerhouse right there on Hammer Slough. And as you can see, the amount of resistance that tool, as it was boring its hole through, that's when it met a soft spot, and that drill just sailed right on through, and that's when you get that gap. And every time you see one of those gaps, that's an indication that you've got an issue.
So these are the old springs.
Anyway, but on the seat bed, most of those poles look pretty darn good. So the plan is to to this coming season to field this tool again on the Swan-Bailey line. The Swan-Bailey line is almost entirely wood poles, and we're going to do the cross-country section. That's just over 300 poles in that section, so we're going to try and get out there and sample at least 30 poles this go-round. And based on the results from that, will tell us whether or not we need to escalate our testing rotation, if 30 poles a year is good for now, until in a 10-year cycle, in theory, we would have them all sampled. But if we get in there and with our initial baseline, we discover that we're having a high rate of failures, we can bump that up a little bit and be a little bit more aggressive in our testing program. So, I guess that's it. I got a little bit on the Tidy Lake report. I think most of all, you probably have a chance to read and review that. So, you got any questions?
Any questions?
All right, thank you.
That brings us to Power System Specialist Report. Ed?
Okay, thank you. So I'll move into the first part of my report here is the operations and maintenance. I'm going to point out that we're spending a lot of time making things more efficient out at the plant and making the documentation much more robust. So we did some extensive training on the MAPCOM system, which is our preventative maintenance program, which we've had it in place since like 96. And we've never fully utilized the potential of that plant. We really used it for a tickler to remind us to do projects, and that's about it. So we're stepping up now and using it to document all the work, not just preventative maintenance, so that we can establish actual times and costs for maintenance of equipment. Secondly, the trigger modifications. This project made modifications to the flashboard triggers. Remember here in 2017, we had what I call the partial trigger trip, which was due to thermal expansion, which caused the kickers to slide on those bearings that you see there in the right-hand picture. They slid an eighth of an inch over, and then when it retracted, the weight come off of the trigger, which let the bucket pull the trigger mechanism up into a partial tripped position and unable to reload itself. So we had to manually load it and then had engineers review and come up with some modifications of how to correct that deficiency. Those were completed this summer. So the lever, the trigger lever, was extended in length so that we could have adjustable weights on the back of the lever. There's 450 pounds on the back of that. We were able to move it an inch and a half back and put some positive weight so that there's 2 pounds of positive weight now before the bucket starts to do its travel. And then secondly, we went in and put a load accumulator in between the 14th kicker and the pier, and that puts right at about 2,000 pounds of additional force on that kicker. So thermal expansion, it will force those kickers back into place. And then the last thing here in the report is the gangway and pier replacement at Swan Lake. We took out an old wooden pier and creosote pilings and replaced it with steel galvanized pilings. And gangway and pier. So this should last us the life of the project now.
A lot safer.
A lot safer. The old one was never designed to have vehicle traffic on it, and for the last 15 years at least, we've been using four-wheelers to move freight back and forth. So we got a four-wheeler and a trailer going up and down on questionable pier and gangway. If you stood off to the side and watched it when that four-wheeler went across there, it was like the swinging bridge. Anyway, That's it. Any questions?
No, that's good.
Yeah, they did a good job.
Is that all that you had in your report?
That's it.
All right. Bring us to the Decorative and Engineering Technical Service Report. Robert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First thing I got in there is the snow pillows. I think I reported in this report 1.5 inches of SWE at Swan and 7.5 inches or and 3.5 inches of SWE at Tyee. So kind of want to go over that. This is going to give you an idea. This is at Swan and this picture over here was at Tyee. But what the snow pillow is doing really is in the middle of this platform is just this bathroom scale. That bathroom scale is weighing the amount of weight on it. And because we know the area on that, that's square inches, and the weight of water, the amount of snow on this will give you snow water equivalent. So when we do our snow surveys on the mountain, we take, well, how deep is the snow? But really, what does it weigh? Because I could have 100 feet of snow and there's no water in it, real fluffy, light snow. So we end up converting it to SWE anyway, snow water equivalent. And for example, 1 inch at Tyee of SWE is equal to 2 feet in the lake. Swan is about 1 inch per 1 foot. So that being said, the project was a success. We have it at Swan Lake. It has been integrated into the PLC and is in SCADA and updating. And at Tyee, it's into the PLC and currently being integrated into SCADA. So that's where we are with those projects.
Robert, just a quick question. Do you have a factor that you put into the equation for sublimation?
On the amount of, oh yeah, yeah. So sublimation, depending on the,
decrease the weight.
Well, sublimation would decrease the amount of water, or the amount of SWE inch per foot. So for example, 80% or 20% sublimation means that at Tyee, you'd only get 1.6 feet of water per every inch of.
But there, so basically there is a factor for that, and that would also, there's no factor.
No, the weight would just go down, right?
Right. So
you just measure it directly.
So how do you know then that that is going to equate at the end of the day?
To 2 feet?
Into your reservoir. Is it the historical average? And then you just would assume that the sublimation would be going
to. It's just
going
to go down daily as it subulates.
Okay. So you would see, okay.
Yeah.
We'll just see it real time. We'll see it real time now, where before we would just go up and measure it twice a year or so. That's the value.
Yeah, so when you see my snow pillow report or my snow reports every year when we do a snow survey, you'll see sublimation as part of that. But that's because by the time that water melts and gets to the lake and by the time you get out there to do another survey, you're going to sublimate. But this, like Trey said, it's real time, and you will still sublimate by the time it makes it to the lake. But it's a real time. What do we have on the hill versus what kind of energy we can get out of it? Swan Lake Station Service. I think we already went through this a little bit on the R&R project. We're at 90%, going to 100% design. Expected to be done in January. And then submarine cables. I'm going to take some time here. I sent out a report there a couple nights ago, and I don't know if everyone's got it, but I'm going to just go through this a little bit because I think it's a hot topic for everyone on the board here, and it's good to just take a time out or slow down and go through this. So I put together, it's not really a presentation, it's just bigger pictures, but I want to discuss what's in the document here and where we are, where we're going, and go over some numbers. And I know there's some questions out there, so I anticipate answering some of those questions. But I want to start here with this picture right here. This is the cable, and we've all seen it at some of the board member or at the board meeting in September, I believe, at the or October, the special board meeting in the SEPA office. But most of us have seen this oil field cable. This part here is the paper
field.
liquid filled. mineral liquid. Mineral liquid filled cable. This is what I talk about in the report as being 500 MCM. It's circular mills. It's how big this copper is. And like I mentioned in the report, this can handle at 138,000 volts, this can handle approximately twice what SEPA can ever produce over this one cable. So it's largely oversized for what it needs to do. But looking at this, oil-filled paper, oil-filled oil or liquid, fluid insulation, copper or lead sheath, it keeps all the fluid in. And then you have another layer of insulation here around the outside. This insulation right here is so that you can do testing and determine the integrity of the armor. This is your armor here. So every year we go to the submarine cables, we hook on a meter, and we check, well, how much resistance is between here and this lead sheath. And if that resistance goes down, then we know that we've got a problem with the armor and it's starting to eat into the insulation here. And we've been doing this since 1985.
Is there any indication on C-phase from that car?
Negative. There hasn't been any indication that there's been deterioration of any of our submarine cables for all the testing we've done. So it does lend itself to look as if it's more of natural phenomenon that occurred at a very short pace.
In event related?
Event related. Yeah. But no speculation at this point. But I wanted to go over some of when we talk about TDR. how did we initially find the fault? I wrote the first report, and this is a follow-up report. But time to main reflectometer, we send an impulse, there's a signal on the line, and we look for any kind of change in the signal. So when we first went out there, we had to determine whether it was onshore, offshore, and how far out. And this showed, and it showed it from the other side. You'll see a similar one, but it'll be 16,000 feet, similar dip. But that shows you that when you got to here, you have insulation that is open to air. When it goes up, then it acts like it's shorted. Bathymetric survey results. We got the e-track to come in, and once we knew the distance of the fault from the shore, we needed to see, you know, how the cables were routed and what might possibly be the location. You can see in this, that is the actual cable for cable 4, cable 3, and cable 2. You can see them on the subfloor there. That's a suspension. So it's a 3D image of the bottom. There's a rock. There's cables. But we didn't see anything on this one. This one was identified through the use of a magnometer. And that magnometer is basically like a metal detector. And so by sweeping back and forth, ding, 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 you get these little X's here. And that's how they routed that. Now that told us the route, gave us an idea. But at the time when we got E-Track to do this survey, which was recommended in the first step of the process, they did not have equipment or the vessel to even do sub-bottom, which would be how deep is the cable. And that's going to be our next step. Is we got to figure out, we know the route of it, but is this thing under 3 feet or is it under 30 feet? Because it's going to make the difference. Even whether we go with a repair or we go with a replace, we have to know the depth for removal.
Just a point of clarification. When he's saying how deep, he means how deep into the silt, how far below the surface of the bottom it is. Not just depth as far as seawater depth, but how far it is buried down underneath.
Robert, as we're looking at this right now, so is the Woronosky, that's Woronosky there.
Correct.
And so we're looking sort of towards this bikini going that way, right?
Yeah, so Stikine would be up here, right. Rangel's over here, way over here.
You're looking straight to the bank.
So these lines go straight to bank.
That underwater topography would lend itself to the potential for eddying, because you've got rises, which could cause the silt to drop, right? Is that
Suspensions potentially could be part reason migration of silt, why we have suspension in here. Could be part of this original lay. We don't know for sure. But the question is whether or not we had something happen here that was geological. And that's something that is yet to be identified. But the intent here, the next step on the bathymetric survey process is finding the depth of burial, which is how far below the surface. And then, like I mentioned, that's just another thing that's happening. It doesn't have to be sequential, but it's another thing that's happening that needs to be known, whether we do repair or replace. I talk about in the report the factors of whether or not we can even do a repair. And there's a few of them, but one of them is what do we have to make the repair? Do we have enough cable? And inventory shows that this fluid-filled cable, you see that's a cap right there. It's under pressure. It's got nitrogen blanket on it, and it's 2,000 feet. Doesn't look like brand new cable. That's just cloth, though. It's brand new cable. It might not look that great, but it is absolutely brand new. So 2,000 feet is what we have, and then the question is what do we need? So some concerns on whether or not we have more faulted or more damaged cable than we have spare cable to replace. This is a bathymetric rudimentary drawing of the Stikeen crossing. You got Warnowski Island here, you got Vank Island over here. 0 feet, 2,000 feet, 4,000 feet as you're going across the Stikeen crossing, and then you get out to where 16,900 or whatever at the other end. But the fault occurred over here by Warnowski, at least from our TDR measurements, which put it at 2,000 feet, which puts it at about 300 feet, 50 feet deep, 300 to 400. The deepest part, that's the real steep part. The deepest part of that is at 650 feet. So this right here, through diffusion, even though we hydraulically lock this, which is what you have to do, you don't have any other choice. You have to, or all your fluid will leave the system. But that could potentially have migrated. The fluid would migrate down, and the seawater, seawater would migrate down and damage all of this cable, which is potentially between 4,000 and 2,000. That's potentially 2,000 feet right there. So we got to determine that. There's a couple ways to determine that. I discussed that in the report. One would be to do more time domain reflectometer tests, because as a function of time, that measurement's going to change, and you can identify if the fault has moved along that seafloor. And then the other one is looking at the bellows and taking pressures, because as the salt water migrates in the cable, it's going to change the pressure on either side, because salt water is denser. And so that will also give you indication of how much damage cable. We plan on doing that testing also in January. Rough order magnitudes on the repair. And again, rough. They're conservatively rough, so that's a good thing. Equipment mobilization lump sum, that's a mob-demob cost, about $550,000 high level, depending on the boat, but that's how much it would cost them to get it up here. This is an ITB quote, Island Tug and Barge. They estimated about $153,000 a day to do the work, and our cable consultant's estimating about 20 days. So that's where we came up with this number. Yes?
Robert, that assumes that we have somebody who can splice those cables?
And that is correct. And ITB has assured us that they have identified a splicer. So that...
And does that mean then you also have to make the determination whether you can pull that cable up to splice it there?
That's the depth of burial.
How do you make that? Does a consultant do that then? Are you using the... make that determination?
If it's buried below 3 feet, then we can't pull it up without damaging it. That is the rule of thumb that's on the market right now. So
you can't pull it up without
damaging the cable, or you would have to go out and spray that silt off of the cable somehow. So
air lancet or something like that?
Before you
pull it up. And that's so that would be an incremental cost for repair.
Okay.